7. Stay close, please, the iterator said. No one wander away from the group, and no one make any record beyond written notes without prior permission. Is that clear? They all answered yes. We have been granted 10 minutes, and that limit will be strictly observed. This is a real privilege. The iterator, a sallow man in his 30s called Emont, who despite his appearance possessed what Euphrates Keeler thought was a most beautiful speaking voice, paused and offered one last piece of advice to the group. This is also a hazardous place, a place of war. Watch your step, and be aware of where you are. He turned and led them down the concourse to the massive blast hatch. The rattle of machine tools echoed out to them. This was an area of the ship the Remembrancers had never previously been allowed to visit. Most of the martial areas were off-limits except by strict permission, but the embarkation deck was utterly forbidden at all times. There were 6 of them in the group. Keeler, another imagist called Simon Sark, a painter called Francisco Twell, a composer of symphonic patterns called Tomolo van Kresten, and 2 documentarianists called Avrius Karnis and Borodin Flora. Karnis and Flora were already bickering quietly about themes and approaches. All of the Remembrancers wore durable clothing appropriate for bad weather, and all carried kit bags. Keeler was fairly sure they'd all prepared in vain. The permission they hoped for would not be issued. They were lucky to get this far. She looped her own kit bag over her shoulder and settled her favourite picta unit around her neck on its strap. At the head of the party, Emont came to a halt before the 2 fully armoured lunar wolves standing watch at the hatch and showed them the group's credentials.
"Approved by the equerry," she heard him say.
In his beige robes, Emont was a fragile figure compared to the 2 armoured giants. He had to lift his head to look up at them. The Astartes studied the paperwork, made comments to one another in brief clicks of intersuit vox, and then nodded them through. The embarkation deck, and Keeler had to remind herself that this was just 1 embarkation deck, for the flagship possessed 6, was an immense space. A long, echoing tunnel dominated by the launch ramps and delivery trackways running its length. At the far end, half a kilometre away, open space was visible through the shimmer of integrity fields. The noise was punishing. Motorized tools hammered and ratcheted, hoists whined, loading units trundled and rattled, hatches slammed, and reactive engines whooped and flared as they were tested. There was activity everywhere. Deck crews hurrying into position, fitters and artificers making final checks and adjustments, servitors unlocking fuel lines. Munition carts hummed past in long sausage chains. The air stank of heat, oil and exhaust fumes. 6 stormbirds sat on launch carriages before them. Heavy armoured delivery vehicles, they were void-capable, but also honed and sleek for atmospheric work. They sat in 2 rows of 3, wings extended, like hawks waiting to be thrown to the lure. They were painted white and showed the wolf's head icon and the eye of Horus on their hulls.
"Known as stormbirds," the iterator was saying as he walked them forward. "The actual pattern type is Warhawk 6. Most expedition forces are now reliant on the smaller, standard construct Thunderhawk pattern, examples of which you can see under covers to our left in the hardstand area. But the Legion has made an effort to keep these old heavy-duty machines in service. They have been delivering the Lunar Wolves into war since the start of the Great Crusade, since before that, actually. They were manufactured on Terra by the Indonesic bloc for use against the Pan-Pacific tribes during the Unification Wars. A 12 will be employed in this venture today, 6 from this deck, 6 from aft embarkation 2.
Keeler raised her picta and took several quick shots of the line of stormbirds ahead. For the last, she crouched down to get a low, impressive angle down the row of their flared wings.
"I set no records," Emont snapped, hurrying to her. "I didn't think for a moment you were serious," Keeler responded smoothly. "We've got 10 minutes. I'm an imagist. What the hell did you think I was going to do?"
Emont looked flustered. He was about to say something when he noticed that Karnis and Flora were wandering astray, locked in some petty squabble.
"Stay with the group!"
Emont cried out, hurrying to shepherd them back.
"Get anything good?" Sark asked Keeler.
"Please, it's me," she replied.
He laughed and took out a picture of his own from his rucksack. "I didn't have the balls, but you're right. What the hell are we doing here, if not our job?" He took a few shots. Keeler liked Sark. He was good company and had a decent track record of work on Terra. She doubted he would get much here. His eye for composition was fine when it came to faces, but this was very much her thing. Both the documentarists had now cornered Emont and were grilling him with questions that he struggled to answer. Keeler wondered where Mercedes Ollerton had got to. Competition amongst the remembrancers for these six places had been fierce, and Mercedes had won a slot thanks to Keeler's good word and, it was said, approval from someone high up in the Legion. But she had failed to show up on time that morning, and her place had been taken at the last minute by Borodin Flora. Ignoring the iterator's instructions, she moved away from the group and chased images with her picter. The Lunar Wolf emblem stenciled on an erect braking flap, two servitors glistening with lubricant as they struggled to fix a faulty feed. Deck crew panting and wiping sweat from their brows beside a munition trolley they had just loaded. The bare metal snout of an underwing cannon.
"Are you trying to get me replaced?" Emont asked, catching up with her.
"No.
I really must ask you to keep in line, madam," he said. "I know you're in favour, but there is a limit. After that business on the surface."
"What business?"
she asked.
"A couple of days ago, surely you heard?"
"No."
"Some remembrancer gave his minders the slip during a surface visit and got into a deal of trouble. Quite a scandal. It's annoyed the higher-ups. The primary iterator had to wrangle hard to prevent the remembrancer contingent being suspended from activity."
"Was it that bad?"
"I don't know the details. Please, for me, stay in line."
"You have a very lovely voice," Keeler said. "You could ask me to do anything. Of course I will."
Emont blushed.
"Let's continue with the visit."
As he turned, she took another pict, capturing the scruffy iterator, head down, against a backdrop of bustling crewmen and threatening ships.
"Iterator," she called, "have we been granted permission to accompany the drop?"
"I don't believe so," he said sadly. "I'm sorry. I've not been told."
A fanfare boomed out across the vast deck. Keeler heard and felt a beat like a heavy drum, like a warhammer striking again and again against metal.
"Come to one side! Now, to one side!" Emont called,
trying to gather the group on the edge of the deck space. The drumming grew closer and louder. It was feet. Steel-shod feet marching across decking. 300 Astartes, in full armour and marching perfectly in step, advanced onto the embarkation deck between the waiting Stormbirds. At the front of them, a standard-bearer carried the great banner of the 10th Company. Keeler gasped at the sight of them. So many, so perfect, so huge, so regimented. She raised her picter with trembling hands and began to shoot. Giants in white metal, assembling for war, uniform and identical, precise and composed. Orders flew out, and the Astartes came to a halt with a crashing din of heels. They became statues, as equerries hurried through their files, directing and assigning men to their carriers. Smoothly, units began to turn in fluid sequence and filed onto the waiting vessels.
"They will have already taken their oaths of moment," Emont was saying to the group in a hushed whisper.
"Explain," Van Krasten requested. Emont nodded.
"Every soldier of the Imperium is sworn to uphold his loyalty to the Emperor at the start of his commission, and the Astartes are no exception. No one doubts their continued devotion to the pledge, but before individual missions, the Astartes choose to swear an immediate oath, an oath of moment, that binds them specifically to the matter at hand. They pledge to uphold the particular concerns of the enterprise before them. You may think of it as a reaffirmation, I suppose. It is a ritual re-pledging. The Astartes do love their rituals."
"I don't understand," said Van Krasten. "They are already sworn, but—"
"To uphold the truth of the Imperium and the light of the Emperor," Emont said. "But, as the name suggests, an oath of moment applies to an individual action. It is specific and precise.
Van Krasten nodded. "Who's that?" Twell asked, pointing. A senior Astartes, a captain by his cloak, was walking the lines of warriors as they streamed neatly onto the dropships.
"That's Loken," Emont said.
Keela raised her picter. Loken's comb-crested helm was off. His fair cropped hair framed his pale, freckled face. His grey eyes seemed immense. Mercity had spoken to her of Loken. Quite a force now, if the rumours were true.
One of the four.
She shot him speaking to a subordinate, and again waving servitors clear of a landing ramp. He was the most extraordinary subject. She didn't have to compose around him, or shoot to crop later. He dominated every frame. No wonder Mercity was so taken with him. Keela wondered again why Mercity Oliton had missed this chance. Now Loken turned away, his men all but boarded. He spoke with the standard-bearer and touched the hem of the banner with affection. Another fine shot. Then he swung round to face five armoured figures approaching across the suddenly empty deck.
"This is," Emont whispered. "This is quite something. I hope you all understand you're lucky to see this."
"See what?" asked Sark.
"The captain takes his oath of moment, last of all. It will be heard and sworn to by two of his fellow captains, but, oh my goodness, the rest of the Mournival have come to hear him pledge." "That's the Mournival?" Keela asked, her picter shooting. "First Captain Abaddon, Captain Torgadon, Captain Aximand, and with them Captain Sederi and Targost."
Emont breathed, afraid of raising his voice.
"Which one is Abaddon?" Keela asked, aiming her picter.
Loken knelt.
"There was no need," he began.
"We wanted to do this right," Torgadon replied. "Luke?" Luke Sederi, captain of the 13th Company, took out the seal paper on which the oath of moment was written.
"I am sent to hear you," he said.
"And I am here to witness it," Targost said. "And we are here to keep you cheerful," Torgadon added.
Abaddon and little Horus chuckled. Neither Targost nor Sederi were sons of Horus. Targost, captain of the 7th, was a blunt-faced man with a deep scar across his brow. Luke Sederi, champion of so many wars, was a smiling rogue, blonde and handsome, his eyes blue and bright, his mouth permanently half open, as if about to bite something. Sederi raised the scrap of parchment. "Do you, Garvil Loken, accept your role in this? Do you promise to lead your men into the zone of war, and conduct them to glory, no matter the ferocity or ingenuity of the foe? Do you swear to crush the insurgents of 6319, despite all they might throw at you? Do you pledge to do honour to the 16th Legion and the Emperor?" Loken placed his hand on the bolter Targust held out.
"On this matter, and by this weapon, I swear."
Sederi nodded and handed the oath paper to Loken.
"Kill for the living, brother," he said, "and kill for the dead."
He turned to walk away. Targost holstered his bolter, made the sign of the Aquila, and followed him. Loken rose to his feet, securing his oath paper to the rim of his right shoulder guard.
"Do this right, Garvil," Abaddon said. "I'm glad you told me that," Loken deadpanned. "I've been considering making a mess of it."
Abaddon hesitated, wrong-footed. Torgadon and Aximan laughed.
"He's growing that thick skin already, Ezekiel,"
Aximan sniggered.
"You walked into that," Torgadon added.
"I know, I know,"
Abaddon snapped. He glared at Loken.
"Don't let the commander down."
"Would I?"
Loken replied, and walked away to his Stormbird.
"Our time's up," Emont said. Keela didn't care. That last pict had been exceptional. The Mournival, Sederi, and Targost, all in a solemn group. Loken on his knees. Emont conducted the remembrances out of the embarkation deck space to an observation deck,
adjacent to the launch port from which they could watch the Stormbirds deploy. They could hear the rising note of the Stormbird engines behind them, trembling the embarkation deck as they fired up in pre-launch test. The roaring dulled away as they walked down the long access tunnel, hatches closing one by one after them. The observation deck was a long chamber, one side of which was a frame of armoured glass. The deck's internal lighting had been switched low, so that they could better see into the darkness outside. It was an impressive view. They directly overlooked the yawning maw of the embarkation deck, a colossal hatch ringing with winking guide lights. The bulk of the flagship rose away above them, like a crenellated Gothic city. Beyond lay the void itself. Small service craft and cargo landers flitted past, some on local business, some heading out to other ships of the expedition fleet. Five of these could be seen from the observation deck, sleek monsters at high anchor, several kilometres away. They were virtual silhouettes, but the distant sun caught them obliquely and gave them hard, golden outlines along their ribbed upper hulls. Below lay the world they orbited. 6319. They were above its night side, but there was a smoky grey crescent of radiance where the Terminator crept forward. In the dark mass, Keeler could make out the faint light glow of cities speckling the sleeping surface. Impressive though the view was, she knew shots would be a waste of time. Between the glass, the distance, and the odd light sources, resolution would be poor. She found a seat away from the others and began to review the pics she'd already taken, calling them up on the pictor's viewscreen. "May I see?" asked a voice. She looked up and had to peer in the deck's gloom to identify the speaker. It was Cinderman, the primary iterator. "Of course," she said, rising to her feet and holding the pictor so he could see the images as she thumbed them up one by one. He craned his head forward, curious. "You have a wonderful eye, Mistress Keeler. Oh, that one is particularly fine. The crew working so hard. I find it striking because it is so natural, candid, I suppose. So very much of our pictorial record is arch and formally posed. I like to get people when they're not aware of me. This one is simply magnificent. You've captured Garville perfectly there." "You know him personally, sir." "Why do you ask?" "You called him by his forename, not by any honorific or rank." Cinderman smiled at her. "I think Captain Loken might be considered a friend of mine." "I'd like to think so, anyway. You never can tell with an Astartes. They form relationships with mortals in a curious way. But we spend time together and discuss certain matters."
"You're his mentor?"
"His tutor. There is a great difference. I know things he does not, so I am able to expand his knowledge, but I do not presume to have influence over him." "Oh, Mistress Keeler, this one is superb. The best, I should say."
"I thought so. I was very pleased with it."
"All of them together like that, and Garville kneeling so humbly, and the way you frame them against the company's standard."
"That was just happenstance," Keeler said. "They chose what they were standing beside."
Cinderman placed his hand gently upon hers. He seemed genuinely grateful for the chance to review her work. "That pict alone will become famous, I have no doubt. It will be reproduced in history text for as long as the Imperium endures."
"It's just a pict," she chided. "It is a witness. It is a perfect example of what the Remembrancers can do.
I have been reviewing some of the material produced by the Remembrancers thus far, the material that's been added to the expedition's collective archive. Some of it is patchy, shall I say. Ideal ammunition for those who claim the Remembrancer project is a waste of time, funds, and ship space. But some is outstanding, and I would class your work amongst that."
"You're very kind."
"I am honest, Mistress, and I believe that if mankind does not properly document and witness his achievements, then only half of this undertaking has been made. Speaking of honest, come with me." He led her back to the main group by the window. Another figure had joined them on the observation deck and stood talking to Van Karsten. It was the equerry, Malachurst, and he turned as they approached.
"Kirill, do you want to tell them?"
"You engineered it, equerry. The pleasure's yours." Malachurst nodded.
After some negotiation with the expedition seniors, it has been agreed that the six of you can follow the strike force to the surface and observe the venture. You will travel down with one of the ancillary support vessels.
The Remembrancers chorused their delight. There's been a lot of debate about allowing Remembrancers to become embedded in the layers of military activity, Cinderman said, particularly concerning the issue of civilian welfare in a war zone. There is also, if I may be quite frank, some concern about what you will see. The Astartes in war is a shocking, savage sight. Many believe that such images are not for public distribution, as they might paint a negative picture of the Crusade.
We both believe otherwise, Malachurst said. The truth can't be wrong, even if it is ugly or shocking. We need to be clear about what we are doing and how we are doing it, and allow persons such as yourselves to respond to it. That is the honesty on which a mature culture must be based. We also need to celebrate, and how can you celebrate the courage of the Astartes if you don't see it? I believe in the strength of positive propaganda, thanks in no small part to Mistress Keeler here and her documenting of my own plight. There is a rallying power in images and reports of both imperial victory and imperial suffering. It communicates a common cause to bind and uplift our society.
It helps, Cinderman put in, that this is a low-key action, an unusual use of the Astartes in a policing role. It should be over in a day or so, with little collateral risk. However, I wish to emphasize that this is still dangerous. You will observe instruction at all times and never stray from your protection detail. I am to accompany you. This was one of the stipulations made by the War Master. Listen to me, and do as I say at all times. So, we're still to be vetted and controlled, Keeler thought. Shown only what they choose to show us. Never mind. This is still a great opportunity. One that I can't believe Mercedy has missed. Look! Cried Borodin Flora. They all turned. The Stormbirds were launching. Like giant steel darts they shot from the deck mouth, the sunlight catching their armored flanks. Majestically, they turned in the darkness as they fell away, burners lighting up like blue coals as they dropped in formation towards the planet. Bracing himself against the low overhead handrails, Loken moved down the spinal aisle of the lead Stormbird. Lunar wolves, impassive behind their visors, their weapons locked and stowed, sat in the rear-facing cage seats either side of him. The bird rocked and shuddered as it cut its steep path through the upper atmosphere. He reached the cockpit section and wrenched open the hatch to enter. Two flight officers sat back to back, facing wall panel consoles, and beyond them two pilot servitors lay, hard-wired into forward-facing helm positions in the cone. The cockpit was dark, apart from the coloured glow of the instrumentation and the sheen of light coming in through the forward slitports.
"Captain,"
one of the flight officers said, turning and looking up.
"What's the problem with the Vox?" Loken asked. "I've had several reports of comm faults from the men, ghosting and chatter."
"We're getting that too, sir,"
the officer said, his hands playing over his controls.
"And I'm hearing similar reports from the other birds. We think it's atmospherics."
"Disruption?"
"Yes, sir. I've checked with the flagship, and they haven't picked up on it. It's probably an acoustic echo from the surface."
"It seems to be getting worse," Loken said.
He adjusted his helm and tried his link again. The static hiss was still there, but now it had shapes in it, like muffled words.
"Is that language?" he asked.
The officer shook his head.
"Can't tell, sir. It's just reading as general interference. Perhaps we're bouncing up broadcasts from one of the southern cities, or maybe even army traffic."
"We need clean vox," Loken said. "Do something."
The officer shrugged and adjusted several dials.
"I can try purging the signal. I can wash it through the signal buffers. Maybe that will tidy up the channels."
In Loken's ears, there was a sudden seething rush of static, and then things became quieter suddenly.
"Better," he said.
Then he paused. Now the hiss was gone, he could hear the voice. It was tiny, distant, impossibly quiet, but it was speaking proper words.
"Only name you'll hear."
"What is that?"
Loken asked. He strained to hear. The voice was so very far away, like a rustle of silk. The flight officer craned his neck, listening to his own headphones. He made minute adjustments to his dials.
"I might be able to," he began.
A touch of his hand had suddenly cleaned the signal to audibility.
"What in the name of terror is that?"
he asked. Loken listened. The voice, like a gust of dry desert wind, said,
"Summers, that's the only name you'll hear. Summers, it means the end and the death. Summers, I am Summers. Summers is all around you. Summers is the man beside you. Summers will gnaw upon your bones. Look out. Summers is here."
The voice faded. The channel went dead and quiet, except for the occasional echo pop. The flight officer took off his headset and looked at Loken. His face was wide-eyed and fearful. Loken recoiled slightly. He wasn't made to deal with fear. The concept disgusted him.
"I don't know what that was," the flight officer said.
"I do," said Loken. "Our enemy is trying to scare us."